This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week, we're still talking about social change to save the environment and ourselves. From the farm in Somerton, Tennessee, deep green thinker and activist Albert Bates on tough transition, how to make a local community work, even if people can't agree on why it must. Then we're going to one of the fathers of movements like transition and localization, Dr. Mark Roseland. His 1992 book, Toward Sustainable Communities, became the handbook for local and regional politicians, nonprofits, and citizens. Now it's out in a fourth edition with the goal of providing, quote, solutions for citizens and their governments. Then we'll get a call for revolution. From the maker of the movie Sharkwater, Rob Stewart says the species we need to save now is us. I've seen his new film, Revolution. It's the ultimate challenge, literally. Our do-or-die time to save ocean life and all life from mass extinction. Our coverage of the dying oceans continues. All coming your way this week on Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. Here comes Albert. Just like organisms, there are simple people. Others, like Albert Bates, are complex. He's a former attorney, a designer, a biochar expert, an author, a speaker, an international and local organizer. Albert has lived at the famous intentional community called The Farm in Somerton, Tennessee, since 1972. His book, Climate and Crisis, was published back in 1990, with more following like The Post-Petroleum Survival Guide and Cookbook in 2006 and The Biochar Solution in 2010. I've called up Albert to ask him about forming a transition community in the rural, somewhat Republican South. Albert Bates, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me here, Alex.
I gather you listen to Radio EcoShock.
I do. I've been a regular listener since it started podcasting, and I like to listen to it when I bicycle around.
Perfect. Well, you know, in last week's program, we heard from successful transition towns in New England, and that's easy enough with progressive voters. Albert, can it be done in a conservative red state like Tennessee?
Well, we found it was certainly a challenge. Let me take you just back a step. The farm has been here since 1971, and when we first landed here, a bunch of hippies in long line of school buses coming from California from the Haight-Ashbury, we were like Martians landing, and the people didn't know what to make of us. There was rumors going around that we were financed by the Bank of Hanoi or that somehow we were in league with the devil. And over time, we gradually won over our neighbors, working outwards gradually to help out in various ways in the community and to be nonviolent and full participants. And people came to respect us. It got to where you could probably cash a check on long hair out to about a 25-mile radius. But then, as time goes on now, I'm looking at over my fence, and I'm seeing all of the issues that are striking my neighbors in Tennessee, and we're teaching permaculture, and we're teaching natural building, and we're doing all these wonderful things here within the intentional community. But just over the fence, we've got all my neighbors who are still doing things wrong, using way too much electricity, not at all prepared for peak everything, wondering why they're losing their retirement savings and why suddenly the climate is so much warmer. And so I'm rushing around trying to do some education and trying to help, you know, because I think you really do have, you're not secure just by yourself. Even an intentional community like the farm, which is fairly well established and has become more or less an eco-village over the years, we're still not really secure unless our neighbors are secure. And the farther out we can reach when calling people neighbors, the better. And so I've been starting working with the groups in the local county. Now, there are not too many of what I call the psychographic as opposed to demographic people here, like the farm people, you know, with long hair and a history of being in San Francisco back in the day. Instead, what we're looking at is several generations of Tennesseans, you know, dirt farmers, people who were poor and remember the last depression and things like that. And a lot of them working now in jobs that are, you know, owned by outside corporations or big box stores, and so they're kind of caught up in that economy. Local banks tend to be owned by some distant corporation somewhere, and so they're sort of all stuck in that new globalized economy, and I'm trying to pry them loose. In fact, a lot of people here on the farm are working with me on this. And so around 2006, after I'd finished with my post-petroleum survival guide cookbook, I decided it was time to devote a little time, energy, and money into raising consciousness in Lewis County, Tennessee. And so we started this program. Initially, we just called it, I was already familiar with Rob Hopkins and the work he was doing in starting Transition Towns at that time, but we started just calling it Film Night. And we might bring in outside speakers, or we might have potluck dinner or something, but we got working with a local church and then a local chamber of commerce and started doing this film night and got space in the school, the town school, and started doing that. And, you know, I'm in a county, the whole county has a population of under 4,000 people, and it's been pretty stable at that, but it's very small, very rural, and very poor. And so, you know, to get people out on a weeknight to watch a movie is not always easy, but we would show things like An Inconvenient Truth or different movies that like The End of Suburbia, things like that, and to try to get a little consciousness raising going. And we would bring in speakers, and we brought in Catherine Austin Fitz, who was a former Bush administration official, but very knowledgeable about the economy and giving people good advice. And then brought in David Bloom, and he could talk about alcohol and how to make your own alcohol and immediately relate to the old-timer moonshiner community here in Tennessee. No problem relating there at all. And he could start bringing in little principles of permaculture as he's talking about how to make home alcohol. So those kinds of speakers were very influential. People here don't believe in climate change. They don't believe in peak oil. So if you raise those subjects, you get looked at like you're some kind of weirdo conspiracy theorist. And we had to kind of avoid those tripwires as we got going. So what we found was we could approach people on the basis of their Swiss heritage. This town here was settled by Swiss immigrants back after the removal of the Indians, you know, Andrew Jackson and the ethnic cleansing that came to the Trail of Tears. That all led to Swiss immigration into the area brought in by the railroads to make railroad ties from the forest here. And that heritage we could relate to because we could say, okay, when we say green, we mean no waste, frugal, okay? Let's be frugal. And so people related to that, and we started having these nights where we would just gather together and talk and come up with ideas for community beautification projects. But what we were really doing was looking at food security and personal security, bringing the lowest, poorest people up into the basics for what they need in health and raising their children and so forth. And so we could do projects like a farmer's market, a monthly flea market. We could do projects like a community kitchen where people could bring their home garden food and make it into some value-added product that we could sell at the flea market. We could do different kinds of things like a business incubator, which would start thinking about local businesses, not foreign-owned businesses here in town that would keep the dollars in cycle. And then around 2008, we had our first what we called the financial permaculture course, which gave us an opportunity to explain permaculture, but it was in the sense of improving your financial outlook. And we had 130 people show up for that, which was great. We issued chamber bucks, which was our first alternative currency here, where we would redeem your chamber dollars, which we issued in $5, $10, and $20 denominations at any local store that was a member of the Chamber of Commerce. So it had to cycle within the community. In that way, in small ways, without actually trying to cross any red lines that would anger people, we gradually won over the population. I mean, I still get occasionally some issues coming up, like, is transition towns part of Agenda 21? Because they see Agenda 21 as this UN plot for one world government. And they don't want to be associated with anything to do with that. And we say, well, we're not political. But we did become the 25th transition town. We got the mayor and the city council, all 16 county commissioners, to join, and to every single elected official in Hohenwald, Tennessee, signed on to a proclamation. And we had the great rollout, unleashing of our transition town, and became the 25th transition town in the United States.
That is amazing. And you've raised an interesting issue on a broader perspective, too, because, as you say, when the farm began in the 70s, it was part of the hippie movement. And now with peak oil and a rotten economy, we're seeing a surge of very different folks, some with guns and deep basements. I'm wondering, is the great change going to work with such different actors?
It's a good point. And it's funny, too, because I just this past weekend was speaking at the Mother Earth News Fair in Pennsylvania. And I just happened to get with the folks at Ogden Publishers who provide Mother Earth News and a lot of other good magazines. And they said that they were a little bit concerned lately because they've noticed their readership changing. Their readership used to be homesteaders, young couples starting out trying to learn to farm. And lately, it's more the survivalists who are interested in gold, guns, and ammo. And so they're wondering whether they should cater their advertising to that or what they should do. But I think that this is a concern for lots of places, and I kind of call it the zombie scenario, okay? So people say, well, it's all good for you to leave the city and go out and live in the country, but what happens when the power goes out and people turn to the countryside looking for food? You're going to be a sitting duck. And I call that the zombie scenario, where people from the cities flood out and take over the countryside. But, you know, I don't actually believe it. I don't think it's very realistic. I think people might get 5 miles away from home, not much farther. But the thing about the countryside is it really is about taking care of neighbors and understanding that your whole population out here is one big family. You're all in it together. If we can reach out and begin to be friends across whatever differences we have, you know, they've been getting along here between the Baptists and the Pentecostals and the Methodists for years. We ought to be able to get along, too. Just by showing that we're good-spirited, good-willed, and harmless, we can get along.
And if I asked you for three hot ideas for people working towards transition in their town or city, what comes to mind?
You know, one of the things that we did here that I think is a good one, and I didn't hear mentioned on your show last week, was that the business incubator. So a lot of people, this is a hot topic in the Romney campaign, that there's all these regulations stifling small business, and it's very difficult for someone to start a small business, and banks are not lending and so on. Well, good. We don't need to be taking loans from banks. We could actually self-finance. We can create our own businesses locally without becoming betrothed to some distant transnational corporation or some vulture from venture capital. The better thing to do is to find a group of neighbors or the whole group like the Transition Towns Initiative and put together a line of credit. Some central lending program where people contribute maybe $5 a month or something into a pool, and then someone can come and take a loan. And that way, you can begin to look at businesses that might be started, and you have elders who have done businesses before, and they could lend their advice and say, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea, or maybe this would be a good idea if you just did this little bit of change to your plan, and then offer some space. There's lots of vacant retail space. We're discovering this. In this economy, one of the things that's in great abundance is empty rooms and empty buildings. And so we can actually get you retail space that would be donated, you know, if you just pay the taxes on it. You don't have to pay any rent, just pay the taxes on it. And that kind of thing, getting people together to launch small businesses and then begin to cycle the money locally within the local economy, just to keep it here, keep it moving around from person to person within the community.
Albert Bates, how do you relate the transition movement to another you helped develop, the EcoVillage Network?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex, because I think there's a strong connection there, and the people in the EcoVillage movement have been very aware of and actually very active in transition as well since transition got started. We began organizing the EcoVillages into a network back around 1994, 95, in that period. And then Rob Hopkins began getting going with his program in Ireland, which was the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Planning process that he did in the Kinsale College, which then evolved into the Transition Towns movement from Totnes, England. And we were following along and helping out. Rob was at some of the conferences that the eco-villagers put on in Scotland. So all of those kinds of techniques that Rob was using, actually a lot of those have been tried out in experimental form within eco-villages, like complementary currencies and so forth. Really, eco-villages are an experimental vessel. And I think in terms of any intentional community, it's stronger to go out with a bunch of people and live on the countryside and do things. Maybe you can even re-inhabit some part of the city and do things as a group. You're much stronger and more stable and more resilient doing it as a group than you would be as an individual or as a small family. On the other hand, if you're out there pioneering these new things and you're trying to be sustainable in every way, it's a whole systems challenge. It can be expensive. You can run into city and county regulations. All of these things are challenges for you. And so really, eco-villages are an experimental vessel. And transition towns are taking the learnings, the gleanings of the best of the eco-village experiments, and turning those into real on-the-ground things wherever people are anywhere in the world.
So how would you compare transition communities in North America with those growing in the rest of the world?
I think North America is very slow, and it's partly, I would call, the depth of the fog or the thickness of the fog here. We've got this sort of media pollution that affects all of our brains. And we're shrouded in it from the time we're children. And to pierce through that veil and to actually see what's going on in the world is much more difficult in North America than it is in many other parts of the world. So we're handicapped. And for us to learn from other places is a good thing. But like I mentioned earlier, we got a lot of suspicion from our county people over the Agenda 21. And isn't that some strange plot to take over the world? So people are reluctant to mirror what's going on in England or Germany or Italy or anywhere else. They want to do things the American way. Well, they're in there. That can be problematic because this is a fairly wealthy country and it's based on a cycle of consumption and waste that's enormous and difficult to break, but it has to be done. Other countries are already living much closer to reality than North America is. And so to answer the question, it's going much better in many parts of the world than it's going in North America. Transition towns movement struggles here. It does it by inches. In other places, they're going by leaps and bounds. Eco-villages as a movement is growing the most in the two-thirds world, out there in Latin America and Asia. And, you know, look at Sri Lanka where there's thousands of eco-villages already. To try to get North Americans to do these things, it's really an uphill fight.
Actually, you've given me some hope there. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the alternative leader, Albert Bates. As you would know, Albert, the American South is experiencing record numbers of super hot days and recurring droughts. What is the farm doing to prepare for a changed climate?
This is actually something we've been studying for a number of years. You mentioned in the setup that I wrote the book called Climate in Crisis back in 1990, and that was kind of my awakening. I was an environmental attorney in my earlier incarnation in the 70s and 80s, and I was fighting against a local chemical company that was injecting their waste products into a deep well and poisoning an aquifer. And their argument was, Tennessee's got plenty of surface water. You don't need to worry. You can go ahead and pollute the deep well. And my argument was, what about population and what about climate change? And so in 1980, I was having to go into a courthouse and prove that there is a serious possibility of climate change here in Tennessee. And so I brought in experts, and I went to my local congressman, a young kid by the name of Al Gore, and he started looking into it and getting into having hearings at Congress and sending me the reports. And we actually won that case and stopped deep well injection, which has actually stopped fracking here in Tennessee, at least for the time being, although they're trying to put in some exemptions now for oil and gas. But it also scared me. And I ended up putting all my material together into this book, Climate in Crisis. And the farm has a land use committee, and our land use committee's objective is to try to keep our land as healthy and biodiverse as humanly possible. And so in that vein, we're looking at what are we going to do when there's 50 or more 100-degree days per year? What are we going to do when our oak forest can no longer stand up to the waves of heat and drought? What do we do when we've had 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months with no rain? What's going to happen to our fields? What's going to happen to our farming? What's going to happen to our ponds and our horses and our chickens and everything else? So from that standpoint, we're doing what we call carbon farming. And here at my Eco Village Training Center, we've been doing carbon farming courses, teaching people about no-till organic, teaching people about keyline plow methodologies where you bring water from the valleys up to the ridges using the plow technique, teaching people about holistic management in terms of mob grazing, the way the buffalo used to manage this land rather than the current methods, and all these different techniques, adding biochar, adding compost teas, spreading compost with manure spreaders. All of those things are enriching the fields and holding more moisture, which is the key factor. I mean, we can come along and build ponds, but really we want to do is take the water and recharge our aquifers, having as much of the land absorb water and hold it when it rains as possible. That and putting cisterns on every house, catching water off every roof, and having lots of ponds in the landscape.
Well, we've got some great ideas. We've got some great science. We've had some good experimental work. We kind of know what to do, and yet something's holding us back. The old paradigm is still dominant. What is it?
You know, if I had the answer to that, I would be a very wealthy man. How do you change people? We carry this neurobiological baggage going back to our reptilian brain where we're attracted by shiny things and we consume and then we throw away. And these kinds of things are inbred to a degree, and we can deal with those by training our children better to be more responsible and to not waste. But it's a long process, and there's a lot of resistance because we're taught in quite the opposite for the most part today. So how do we do it? My feeling is shows like this, Alex, what you're doing on the radio, we need to get that more. We need to have our media filled up with this. We need to have celebrities coming out and doing movies about this sort of thing that are actually entertaining. We need to have the popular culture take this on as a fashion. That's my idea. And I'm beginning to call it cool, because I think cool is a more attractive word than global warming. I like the carrot rather than the stick. And so I want to adopt a lifestyle that's cool. I want to plant as many trees as would necessarily offset my personal footprint from travel. I want to have my food come out of a garden which is actually sequestering more carbon than it's sending to the atmosphere. That's cool. That's cool living. And so having cool living, I think some ways to attract people into this as a fashionable statement, as something that people do with a sense of pride, I think is a good thing.
Well, listeners, I'll put some links to the work of Albert Bates in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Albert, would you care to give us a couple, like maybe your Twitter feed or a Facebook page or a blog or something?
Yeah, since I did the post-petroleum survival guide, I had kind of a surfer theme in that, because I thought that that's kind of what we're doing here, is we're surfing all these volatile waves of peak everything. And so I'm calling myself Peak Surfer, one word. And so on Twitter, it's at Peak Surfer, and my blog is peaksurfer.blogspot.com, and you'll find my work linked all from there. And also, our main website for the farm is thefarm.org.
Well, as a former surfer, I endorse all that. From the farm in Somerton, Tennessee, we've been talking with one of the biggest and best alternative thinkers and activists of our times, I think, Albert Bates. Albert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alex, and have a good day.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Deep Forest, Computer Machine. We've been talking about transition from Europe through New England to the American Deep South. There is more to come. We can't stop talking about what to do, except to get busy doing it. Transition has some surprising support from local governments, perhaps more than you know. A lot of mayors, faced with very tough economic times, without enough help from national governments, they are leading the way. They are the green mayors with a vision of cities with much lower carbon emissions, much less dependent on fossil fuels, and a good food supply. They want a sustainable future. This wave has been building since at least 1992. As we'll hear, the few expert pioneers out there have become a network of community builders, a huge database of folks from around the world that are connecting. It's one of the signs of hope. I'm going to challenge you to tune in with a slightly different language, with new ears, to one of the pioneers of localization and sustainable community, Dr. Mark Roseland. It's a messy world. We are bombarded by negative stories. Big governments seem to fail to make our lives better, and they can't seem to save us from threats like climate change either. Many of our Radio EcoShock guests say only local governments are worth your political attention. And that's why you need to hear Mark Roseland. He's been advising local governments how to build on a human scale for cities that can keep going through many challenges. Dr. Mark Roseland is director of the Simon Fraser University Center for Sustainable Community Development, and he's a professor in the Resource and Environmental Management Program. You know, Dr. Roseland came to our attention back in 1992 with the release of his best-selling book, Toward Sustainable Communities, Resources for Citizens and Their Governments, and that book is being released in a fourth edition in September 2012. Mark Roseland, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You know, at first, I had a hard time approaching your work. There were acronyms I didn't know. I was wondering to myself, is anything real going on here? And then I started to clue in. So why don't you tell us about one or two projects actually built with your advice or involvement?
Sure. Well, one of them that I've been very involved with is the community at Simon Fraser University. It's actually a community, a neighborhood of the city of Burnaby, where Simon Fraser is located, but it's called University. And I have been on the board of the trust that is developing that community since its inception in about 1999. So I've seen that from just a really an idea to a community that now has about nearly 4,000 residents and has a school and daycare center, all kinds of great amenities, and will eventually house at least 10,000 people. And we are trying there to do many of the things that I have written about in my books and other research, the kinds of things that many municipalities are trying to do as individual initiatives, are trying to put them all together at University.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, the weekly environment and community building program broadcast by over 62 stations on three continents. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with one of the pioneers, Dr. Mark Roseland, author of the book Toward Sustainable Communities. Some Americans on the political fringe have made the sensible idea of sustainability into a dirty word. When we return, I'll ask Mark Roseland, is he part of the worldwide conspiracy to enslave humanity using the United Nations and Agenda 21? Stay tuned.